Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you are listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Because what it takes to write the book you most want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you most want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, you can go to pnwa.org, and this is just about the time of the year when they are wrapping up their yearly writing conference, or contest. They have numerous categories, from YA to short memoir to children's to thriller, romance. And it's quite a good contest, I have to say. And a lot of people have gotten agents and publishing deals from it, not just the winners, but some of the people who simply placed in the top four or five. So if you are inclined to enter contests, I encourage you to head over to pnwa.org and do so ASAP. It's my opinion, if writing is really taught, and writing has taught me this, but it's my opinion that really we're only here on this planet to find what pleases us. And I mean that in the sort of the deepest way you can. What is the fullest expression of your own happiness, your joy, your interest, your curiosity? There's really no other reason I can think of to be here and to spend my time. And as a writer, sometimes that means writing one thriller after another, or one poem after another. But for some writers, like my guest today, Kate Campbell, that means moving around a little bit sometimes in the genres. Kate, most recently, she just published her second historical novel, Hall of Secrets. But this book, her first historical novel was Benedict Hall, and Hall of Secrets just came out. Though this is her second historical novel, this is simply the latest iteration in her writing career. It included at least 10 novels in science fiction and fantasy, of all things. But now she's writing in historical, and how does one do that? How does one move around that much? I'm always curious about that, but the best one to ask is Kate herself, who's with me right now. Kate, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
So, Kate, as I mentioned in our intro, these two novels, Hall of Secrets and Benedict Hall, are your latest evolution as a writer, but where did it really begin? Do you remember when you first sort of... Or the concept that story mattered to you was of value to you, that you were interested in it? Can you remember when that first lit up in your mind?
Well, I was a very small child because I was an avid reader as a little girl, and it's always been my secret pleasure to slip away somewhere with a book. So I think I would have to say it started then, and then I pursued a different career, as many writers do. And about 20 years ago or so, I started feeling that urge to create my own stories. And I still remember exactly how it felt to have this idea in my mind and the need to try it out. I didn't really anticipate being a professional writer. I just really wanted to tell a story that I had in my mind. And as you
said, you can remember
Oh, yes. I remember it very clearly because it was just sort of chewing at me. You know, I have a friend who says she has to write to get the stories out of her head, and I think I felt a little bit like that. Also, I wanted to explore it more, and my style of writing is to start with the germ of an idea and then try to discover where it's going, which is fun for me. Like, just like it's fun to read a novel that you're truly enjoying, or a short story, to write a novel that you truly enjoy is the same sort of pleasure for me.
Yeah. The same sense of discovery and learning where it's going, right? Just as you would a book.
So that means I don't plan too far ahead, because if I know everything before I start writing, all the sort of joy of discovery has gone out of it.
You know, it's such a good point, and it kind of harkens back to what I was talking about in my little intro there. And I think about this a lot when I'm teaching students and when I do my own writing, that so much of your job as a writer is to really surrender to your own curiosity, which means to give up the idea of control but over anything but your curiosity, interest, and following it authentically. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense to me. It's one of the reasons that I, in my own teaching of writing, I advise so strongly against trying to write to a specific market. I think the writer does much better when he or she writes something she or he is passionate about. Because in the end, even if you make a lot of money with a book, the money gets spent, the reviews are forgotten, and in the end, that work is what you have. And so I think we should all create work that is deeply personal and meaningful to us. And then we'll be happy whether we make a lot of money or a little bit of money or have tons and tons of readers or just a few. In the end, we'll have that work that really matters to us. So I liked what you said in your intro about being in this world in order to find our truest expression of ourselves.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And actually, it goes back to what you just said, which is that what you told your students, because it's absolutely true the money will get spent. And the reviews will be for sure forgotten, except for everybody but the writer who seems to hang on to all the bad ones anyway.
So true. But they will generally be forgotten. Instant memorization.
It's horrible. But for everybody else, will be forgotten. But but the work will still be there. But even more important, I think maybe the what you went through to create the work can never be taken from you. I mean, I feel like I grow every day a little bit. Anyway, every day that I write something, if something shifts in me ever so slightly, and that'll never go anywhere because it's in me then. Do you feel like that sometimes?
Yeah, I think it's true of all artists who practice. I have a number of friends who are visual artists as well, and I think you're absolutely right. It's a constant growth, and if it's not, if you've settled into doing something by formula, then As a visual artist friend of mine just said the other day, she said, then you're just doing tourist dreck. It's not art anymore. It becomes just a product. So yeah. I think you're absolutely right.
It takes
we do
a certain
better things when we're curious.
Curiosity. Well, you know, that's what Einstein said. He said, genius is curiosity. It's curiosity.
I didn't know that. That's great. Yeah. That's
but it's
great.
True in a way. Because the times that people have said of me, and it's not been that often, but every once in a while it happens, they'll say, oh, that's really smart, or that's, I won't say genius, but we'll say really smart. It was a product of me getting curious and being so curious that I leave my attention on something a long time that I can say something about it that maybe is illuminating to somebody else. But it was really my curiosity more than anything else, you know?
And
so,
curiosity... Yeah. In its forms is what makes a story compelling. So first the author is curious, and secondly, then if the author does her job, then the reader is curious, and that keeps them turning pages.
What's going to happen next? Why did they do that?
What's going to happen next? That's right. And don't you love that stage where you don't really know what's going to happen next, both as the writer and the reader?
And, you know, it's also the question is a lot of times you'll have, especially if you're writing fiction, you'll have a character, you know, you might be writing along, and it sounds like this sort of thing probably happens to you. And let's say you have a protagonist who says, well, you know, my father died when I was 8, and that's the first time you, the author, knows that, and now you ask yourself, I wonder how the father died. Have you had that kind of experience where they say something, you know it's true, but you don't know why it's true yet?
Right, and that's part of the great fun of it, I think, is exploring. I went through a period about 5 years ago where I was trying to read a lot of old novels to see why they were still relevant today and what the authors did. Mary Stuart. Mary Stuart was one of them. And I noticed that one of the things that she did was to really develop minor characters. So minor characters had their own history. So you didn't have just ciphers on the page. You had people who, even if they were only in one scene, but they actually had a life. And I thought it helped bring her entire novel to life. So I think that's a really good point. Also, sometimes that curiosity leads you into subplots that are almost as valuable as the principal plot of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of my favorite stories, I can't remember, he's an Irish suspense writer, and I can't remember his name now. He was a very nice guy. And we were talking about this experience of having characters surprise you. And he had a woman who was, I think, a prostitute or something, and he just needed to get her from point A to point B. You know, from this warehouse to this hotel room or something. And he said, okay, someone's going to drive her in a van. And that he just, I need someone to drive her in a van. So, okay. But he's naturally asked himself, well, who is driving this van? He asked himself. And the answer came back, it's a serial killer, and he's going to take her to his room and kill her for her teeth. That was his answer. And he said, well, I guess that's the answer. Now I've got a different story than I thought I had. But that was the first answer that came to him.
And the great thing about those ideas is, I'm a former singer, opera singer actually, and so I'm really into drama. And I think when we come up with these really strange ideas like that, and we're going to make it work on the page, that's getting to the most dramatic impact we can find, and it's worth all the time and energy that it takes trying to explore that, because what we're doing in novels and stories is we're actually creating drama, and I like them to be big and operatic and dramatic. So
that's so funny. So yes, we are creating drama. I was thinking about this. Tell me what you think about this, because it's true. You've got to have drama. You've got to have this conflict in your stories, and yet we do have to create it in a way, because the end of the story is always when that drama is finally released and resolved and people come to rest. Right? I mean, they finally, in a way, usually find out who they are. Maybe the villain is finally killed, but they understand their value. That all the tension, and so you're aiming for a point where there is no drama. The end result is always the end of drama. But when first we need it to get there. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. So you have resolution at the end. And in the meantime, I always love it. Do you use in your teaching Freytag's pyramid, you know, which starts with you set the context for the story, and then you have the rising action, the falling action, and the resolution.
I do not use that, no.
You don't,
yeah.
Well, it's very simple. I use it especially when I'm teaching young writers, because it's, because it's nice and visual and simple, and it's a good way of looking at things. I sort of picture it that way. But I do agree, and the more dramatic the story is, then the more satisfying the release of the tension, the resolution of the drama is. Even when it's a tragedy, even tragedies, you have release of tension because the story has come full circle.
Yeah, in tragedy, the hero or heroine is holding a sort of false belief about themselves, and that kills them. Usually that is the thing that brings about their demise. And so that false belief dies with them. I mean, opera's full of that, right? Of somebody offing them, of being off. But they die because, like Oedipus or, Hamlet to some degree, and for sure Gatsby, because of some false belief. And then the release with the reader, so here I'm going academic on you, but the release for the reader is that seeing that false belief perish, even if it's within the, and so you're released from it. How's that?
Yes. So I don't know how you would categorize the kind of tragedy that I've written wherein the protagonist is actually a sacrificial figure and dies for an ideal.
Oh.
So it actually, it lends... It lends deeper meaning to the sacrifice because of the belief that the protagonist held and put into action.
Because in a way, the idea is more important than the body. The spirit's more important.
Right, and than so the only opera
sort of
I can think of that does that is the Dialogue of the Carmelites, where a bunch of Carmelite nuns are killed in the French Revolution. It's a really cheerful opera.
Actually, it's one of the most, and to go biblical, the story of Jesus technically is that the idea of spirit is more important than the body. So the spirit is ultimately the thing that you are. So the idea, so it's the same thing. book.
Right. And even in fiction, you can look at Tolkien, because the figure of Frodo is a sacrificial figure.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, that has its roots in Christianity.
Very much. And he's a pure character. Yes. He has no real vice to speak of, except that the ring weighs on him. But he's a pure character, pure heart. So interesting. You know, a lot of times when I teach writing now, I'm teaching a lot of memoir. And I've been focusing lately on what I call contrast. And this is just what you and I have been talking about. So in other words, if you want to show how, if you're writing, say, a memoir where you show that you found your voice, if that's the resolution, you've got to show what your silence was like, the drama in this case of being silent and what that suffering is. Show me silence so I understand your voice. Show me war so I understand peace. Show me loneliness so I understand love. Yeah? Does that make some sense?
Yeah, that's very good. It does.
Because that's how we see it. That's how we feel it, isn't it?
I think, yes, of course it is, because it's hard to understand the value of peace if you don't know what the opposite of that is.
Oh.
And understand it on some level.
And in fact, when you tell a story, if I tell a story just personally and I want to come to the resolution, it quickly in my mind, if I can, I think what the resolution feels like, then I search for its opposite, heading backwards, and so I can find where it, you know, why was that moment so interesting to me? It had to be because I believed the opposite thing, or I was living the opposite thing. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all drama.
Yes,
all
that works.
All right, so speaking of, well, it's not opposites, but contrast, to go from science fiction and fantasy, well, it's not a huge leap, maybe, but I don't know. It's now you're writing historical fiction. You've written two historical novels, but you're doing science fiction and fantasy before then. Now, so what brought this about? Just, I've got an idea, and by God, I don't care about the genre. Why did this happen? How did this happen?
You know, that really was it. I mean, I started with an idea that was clearly a fantasy novel, and it was something I had always read, was science fiction and fantasy.
Right.
And when I started getting interested in this particular story, there was nothing fantastic about it, and I probably wouldn't have thought of using a pseudonym myself, but my publisher thought that would be a good idea, since it was so different. I had had the same publisher for several years, but my editor thought it would be a nice way to mark the change in genre. And it's worked quite well, because fortunately for me, a lot of my readers in fantasy and science fiction were perfectly happy to go into historical fiction with me, which has been very nice. And I think actually the motivation for reading fantasy and the motivation for reading historical fiction, it's something I would love to do a questionnaire sometime of readers to find out, because I think it's the same motivation. It's to go someplace really different. So in fantasy, you go to a world that doesn't exist, and in historical fiction, you go to a world that did exist but that we no longer are familiar with.
Yeah. Yes, that's so true. And of course, speaking of Tolkien, I mean, he wasn't a historian, but he was a linguist. Was he a linguist? What was he? I can't remember. He was an academic.
Yeah,
well,
he was a linguist, and of course, he was not young when The Lord of the Rings was published.
No, I know.
He was in World War I, and so I think a lot of what he experienced there was expressed in those novels.
I'm sure. But you make a really good point, though, about the visiting, because not only do you, in fantasy, do you need to build a world that, you know, a different world for your readers to enter, but and so important for the fantasy writer is to build that world, to give the reader the physical details of what that's like. Because I could say, because if I wrote about Seattle, say, where I live, 21st century Seattle, I would give you physical details, but the reader would just fill in so many themselves. You know, they wouldn't need me to build it up from scratch. But like this one takes place in Jazz Age Seattle, and you do need to build that up, because I don't actually know what Jazz Age Seattle was like. And so you would a fantasy novel, you're kind of doing the same thing.
Yes, that's exactly right. And it's one of the reasons, I'm sure, I hope that's true, that people like to read historical fiction or historical books because of wanting to know what it was like. And the interesting thing about the 1920s, where I've been working now for several years, is that it's almost like today. It's so close, but just that much different. And so it's been a challenge to make it without telling people a lot of things, but to work in the details so that that sense of it being different. It's like in Downton Abbey, which I love, which is set in the same time period. One day, that wonderful old character, the old countess, the wonderful Maggie Smith,
she
says, first electricity and now the telephone. It's like living in a Jules Verne novel. And it's a wonderful line because it just sets that scene so perfectly.
Yeah, yeah.
It tells you about her and it tells you about her setting.
Yeah.
So we're always looking for that one detail and a nice way to work it in so you're not just saying, oh, there's a telephone on the table.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we've got a caller who would like to ask you a question.
Oh.
And I know who it is. I believe this is Jeffrey. Is that you?
It is I, Bill. Thank you. And I'll speak very quickly. This is another fascinating interview, and you have to. If they're too short, they go by so fast.
Thank you.
Let me get right to Kate. Wonderful interview. Fascinating.
Thank you.
You're an operatic singer, and that discipline and that regimen of all that training, background and experiences, has that had an effect on your own process of writing? Have you been able to meld the two in some way or form?
In so many ways, Jeffrey, that I don't have time to list them, but I would say, first of all, my favorite word in the world is discipline, and the discipline that it takes to be a trained singer applies directly to the discipline that it takes to be a professional or at least a regularly working writer.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I learned from opera, which has been unbelievably valuable to me in my writing, is that the same thing we've been talking about, drama, the building of tension, the release of it, and also pacing and character and color in a scene. I mean, it's just been a really nice nice transition from one career into another.
You know, it's funny
now
that you mention it, Kate, in that I was teaching a class on Saturday, and I was talking about voice. It was really a class on voice. And my analogy I used was singers. And I was when I think of voice, I mean, I think of a writer's voice, but I always think about a singer's voice that is distinctive and clear and so on. And one of the things, of course, in order to sing well, you have to relax, don't you? I mean, the goal is an effortlessness. Even though it's a discipline, to really let the note through purely, you have to allow it through.
Right.
Is that right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so there is a kind of
release tension, right?
Yeah. And I always think of that for me, that's a great analogy for me as a writer because I'm trying to sort of get out of the way to allow my true voice through as a writer, this sort of effortless
relaxation. That's a really, really good point. Yes. Yes, because it's there. You know it's there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And one of the best ways I know to do that as a writer is to eliminate distractions,
you're
not worried about
distractions.
Everything.
In your workspace.
What I'm thinking about these days is the internet and the telephone and the radio and the television. So when you're working, for me, I have to let all of that go so that I can work in and get into the zone, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get the flow going.
Yes, because. You have to get the flow going. The thing about thought, because writing is a form of thought in a way. I mean, you see a scene, and that's like a thought, and then the character does something, that's another thought. And what I found is that thought has a momentum to it. And the faster the thoughts get going, because one thought feeds another, just like you're sitting around complaining, that will lead to one momentum of thought. And so you want to block everything out so you can get the kind of momentum of thought going that leads to the story you want to tell. So you can keep it trained and rolling along down that hill, right?
Yes, I think that's a really good way to describe it. And another thing I'd like to mention, which comes from the discipline of music, is that the brain, I don't have scientific explanation for this, but I believe it because of years of practice, that the brain gets ready to work. And there's a lot of advantages to working at the same time every day.
Yes.
I always practiced singing right after lunch because that was a good time of day physically and mentally. And so when I'm writing, if I know that I'm always going to sit down and start working at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, my brain is preparing all the hours before that to focus on the work. And I really hate missing that window for that reason.
Well, I'll tell you, it's absolutely true for me, and it's true for I've talked to hundreds of writers, and I would say easily 90% of them have a time that they write. That they just need
to
know.
Oh, is that right? That's good. So.
Yeah. I mean, I do it at 6:30. My main writing happens at 6:30 in the morning, and I know that, and that's just where I am. And I do, and I think you're right that you do sort of, you get ready. Now, this is an interesting question. It's one of the things I tell my students, and this is really true. I'm never in the mood to write, but that doesn't have anything to do with whether I write. I mean, I'm never, like, in the mood to write. I just know I'm going to write.
Right.
And then once I get writing, I'll be in the mood to write. Does that resonate with you at all?
Exactly.
Like, I really
that's
think, oh,
exactly right. Because if you wait to be in the mood, it'll never happen.
It'll happen
it's
once
something
every
you
two
create
weeks,
for
maybe.
Yourself.
Yeah. Because
yeah,
you get it.
Yeah.
You, I mean, once you're writing,
absolutely.
You're in the mood.
Yeah.
Yes.
Once
yes.
you're in that flow, and
yes.
then it's fabulous.
It is fabulous, yes. isn't it?
Absolutely.
Isn't it fabulous?
It really is. It's the best. I can't believe that I have a life in which I got to pursue two creative careers. I'm the luckiest person going.
You know, you just somehow, Kate, or you understood that part of life. I'm sure there's something there's always something that we have to spend a long time learning. You know, we have some wall we have to bang our head against for a while before we stop
yes.
doing it. But you got that, it seems to me. You understood how to let that happen.
Well, it feels like it now. There are many, many doubts along the way, of course, as with everyone
yeah.
else. But
sure.
But I do think you're right that we spend our lives finding the most perfect way to express who we are, and I've been fortunate.
What greater gift do you have to give the world than expressing who you are? Because that's, you know, you're nature's own version of perfection, just in your little self. And so, what better gift do you have the world than expressing that fully and without any inhibition? I can think of none. None at all.
Yes, I agree with you.
All right. Well, listen, we have only about 3 minutes left, so I have one more question for you, Kate. This went too quickly, but I'm going to ask it to you now. So here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to finish this sentence for me. You ready?
Okay.
I think you're ready. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me to trust myself.
Yeah. Do you know that's probably the most common answer? Yeah, trust.
Is it? Oh, I'm just so ordinary.
No. No,
but,
and I love to hear
but it's
that.
True that
yeah.
Because if you don't trust what you're doing, you never really express your own view, your own artistic vision, and that's so important. Because
yes.
each of us has our own, and if we let outside influences, whether it's reviewers or people in our critique group or teachers, if we let them change the essence of that so that we don't trust ourselves, then we don't do our best work.
That's right. Yes, that's right, because that thing that you have to share, that story, comes to you in a place where no one else can see it. Who else,
that's
you know,
exactly right.
It's in a
right.
sovereign domain, and that's your imagination. And so only you get to decide if it's any good, if it's worth sharing. Trust,
right.
trust. But we can never learn how to trust enough, can we? I don't think it's possible.
Well, it can be very difficult. There's a lot of negativity around, and we just have to remember some of it is useful, most of it is not. So
yeah.
I always say to my students, sing with your own voice.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Kate, this has been a delight. It's so nice to talk to you.
Yes. Oh, I enjoyed it so much. Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome. Hall of Secrets. It's out where all fine
Hall
books of souls. Yes. Good luck, Kate, and good luck with the next
Thank
one. I'm
you.
Sure it'll be coming along here any day now. Or any month
Yes,
now.
It comes in the fall.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck, and thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Well, trust. Love is trust. It is. I always say do what you love at the end of these shows, but you have to trust to love, because love is, you can't prove love, and you can't disprove fear. Can't prove love. So if you want to do what you love, you must trust that the love will take you where you want to go. You love a story, you write it because it'll take you where you want to go. You love being with a person, being with them will take you where you want to go. You don't know where you're going, you just know that you love the thing you're doing. And that, my friends, is trust, which is what writing requires. So, until, next week, same time, channel. What you love. Write what you love. And you can't go wrong.